I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What's happening, family? Welcome to the podcast In the Black of My Mind. I'm your host, Al Thomas. So kick back, relax, grab your favorite libation and or stimulation and enjoy the ride with us. Now I'm going to need you to do me a favor and go down to the bottom of the page, click subscribe and share and tell everybody. How many bodies? Everybody's. That's right. Today's guest is an amazing Billboard chart-topping sax player, an entrepreneur, graphic artist, a photographer, and a painter who's recorded, performed, and or toured internationally with legendary artists from Norman Conners to Al Jarreau and George Benson, to name just a few. And more importantly to me, this is another one of my big brothers, Marion Meadow. Welcome to the podcast, bro.
Yeah, how you doing, man?
Blessed, man. I'm blessed. I'm so happy that you were able to do it, man.
Oh yeah, we've been trying to do this for a little while.
Yeah.
You know. put the saw on the bird's tail so they can't fly because you're gonna get me to stay still.
Exactly. No, but you're doing your thing, man. I can't be mad. You're doing your thing, bro.
It's been 2024 was really exciting, a lot of moving parts, and it seems as though 2025 is coming in the same way. And you know, the music is alive, is strong, and I'm so glad to still be here doing this.
Yeah, oh, no doubt. And I want to take it back, man. You were born in West Virginia, and then came to Connecticut. How old were you when you came to Connecticut?
I was 5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was 5 years old. We came from West Virginia, and it was we came from a coal mining town. My dad, you know, came to Connecticut like a lot of people did back in those days to, you know, look for a better job, and certainly working in the coal mines was very hazardous to your health. And we had relatives who had black lung, and you know the emphysema is really what it was. They call it black lung, but
right.
You know, it's you can only breathe so much dust from out of a mine before it's going to affect your health. And so my dad said, to my uncle, we can't do that. We got to get out of here. And you remember my Uncle Joe, and and my dad made a pact to come to Connecticut. And actually, it was at first in the Bronx in New York City is where we first landed. Mm-hmm. And my father got a job working in Stamford, Connecticut.
Okay. Uh-huh. I was reading somewhere. No, I was listening to someone interviewed you, and they were saying that you were related to Robert E. Lee.
I was like, "Yeah, that's a strange story."
Yeah.
My great grandmother So my grandmother's mother was a Doyle, and her name was Sarah Doyle, maiden name. And she married a guy by the name of Luther Coleman. And we knew that, but we just didn't know who Sarah Doyle's mother and father were. So my father went in search of that history and who this lady was. He knew what area she came from, which was Lynchburg, Virginia. And in doing so, searching for quite a long time, it became aware to him that for some reason, he can't really find this woman's past, you know. And that was before the times of Ancestry.com and all those kinds of apps. However, he did go to Lynchburg, Virginia, only to meet the lady who ran the historical society there, who happened to be, I think she was like 100 years old. I mean, literally,
Oh, wow.
was, and she was still working and knew all of this history. And as soon as he mentioned the name Sarah Doyle, I mean Liza Doyle, and I correct, it wasn't Sarah, her name was Liza. So his mom's mother's name was Liza, whose mother's name was Sarah. As he found out, this is the historical society. She informed him at the historical society that we know who Sarah Doyle was because Sarah Doyle used to be a cook for Robert E. Lee.
Oh,
She
okay.
was on loan from his brother, and she lived with the slaves. She was a white woman from Ireland, and they were called indentured servants, but the way she explained it, they were really slaves, and
Right.
they could work off their slavery and then return back to Ireland. And usually nobody ever did. They never went back. But maybe you had the opportunity to go back if you wanted to. And part of that was part of that history where they had sent some of the people who were captured during the war between Ireland and England during those times to work off their indentured servitude. And that was what she did. When she was loaned to Robert E. Lee, Robert E. Lee was, down there messing around, I guess.
Okay.
And
Yeah, all
then
right.
she had a couple of children, which then ended up being five children by Robert E. Lee, of which I think the third child was Liza. Liza Doyle was born, she was a bastard child. She was not, a legitimate child of Robert E. Lee. I don't know what his wife thought about it. It might have been a problem. I don't know. He might have got slapped. I don't know, But anyway, so he had this beautiful little girl, Liza, who then grows up, meets Luther Coleman, and gets married and moves. I think originally they had to move out of the state eventually, because they were, well, they didn't have to. But when she did move and they settled, it was in West Virginia.
Okay.
And from Virginia. While in West Virginia, she they got married and had a daughter of their four children. I think it was, no, it's actually five. So one of their daughters was Mary Coleman. And no, actually she was the only daughter. The other three were brothers.
Okay.
So Mary was born to Liza and Luther Coleman. Of course, Liza was the illegitimate daughter of Robert E. Lee. And then their daughter, Mary, married a guy by the name of Albert Grasty. I'm sorry, Walter Grasty. And Walter Grasty would have been the father of the Grasties that you know of my
Oh, okay.
family.
Okay.
Yeah. He would have been the
Okay.
patriarch. He would not have been the father, the grandfather, and in many cases, the great grandfather of the Grassleys that you know. Now, my grandmother Mary's husband Walter died, and she said to her cousin that this guy that boards up your house at your place, he's one of your boarders. I'm really in love with this guy, Albert Meadows, who
Oh,
was my
wow.
grandfather.
Okay. Wow.
And she marries him, and they did get married. The speculation as to, what. So when Liza marries Luther, the speculation that Luther possibly was part Native American, that he wasn't really a white man, and he wasn't, he definitely wasn't a black man, but they could not figure out if Luther, because Luther wore his hair all the way down his back, so
Wow.
which was not a really a that wasn't really a normal thing for, you know, the white settlers in those days, for a man to wear his hair way down. I'm not saying they didn't, but it was typical for Native Americans too. And there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of babies happening during that time who were, you know, people don't realize it was. There were a lot of half-caste babies, you know, Native Americans and blacks and whites and mulattoes, and, you know, so there was a lot of mixed babies coming around at that time. Mary was the child of Luther and Liza, and so my grandmother, my whole life, I consider my grandmother, you know, kind of this little white lady, you know, but maybe not. I couldn't really tell. We couldn't really tell. We didn't really know. So, but when she married Walter Grasty, well, Walter Grasty was already a light-skinned guy. So, you know, if you know the Grastys, you know, back in the old days, the Grasty girls probably could have passed for white, you know, like my aunts did. And so she did marry Albert Meadows and had my father, Otha, and my two uncles, Joe and Michael Pete, you know. And so that's our history. So the Robert E. Lee story is true. At first, when I mentioned it at I was at a dinner party in New York City, and there was a Civil War historian there, and he jumped up from the table and he challenged me that that story was not true. Only later on to write me a letter and apologize that, in fact, it wasn't kept out of the history books
Of course.
about Robert E.
Of
Lee and many
course.
of the other guys' illegitimate children. Of course, they didn't
Right,
want
right, right. I can put that in there.
that. But here I am. So, yeah. And then, so they go, when they talk about America, what, bro, you looking at him? Because,
You got the United Nations under your cap and
United
stuff.
Nations right here, right here. Don't
No
talk
doubt.
about bipartisan. Chief, come on. You looking at him.
Oh, man.
Hi, this is Artie Dixon, and you're watching In the Black of My Mind with my brother Al Thomas.
Now, listen, was any of your family members involved in music?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Grasties, who, you know, were my father's half brother, who was the oldest son of my grandmother Mary. Her first son was George Grasty, and George Grasty was the half brother of my father, because George's dad was Walter, and then when she remarried, she married Albert, and so she had sons from both husbands, and they were the catalyst for us coming to Connecticut, because they already lived in Stamford, Connecticut, and so we had a very close family. There was no animosity between the siblings on both sides, you know, her previous marriage, and it was, my family's always been a wonderful, close family, so they facilitated my father coming from West Virginia, having a place to stay, you know, while he studied, and then eventually us moving, and they were all part of all of that to get us here to Connecticut. And it was, you know, the way people did. That's what they did back in those days. You know, they worked together. They, you know, family was so important. And it was, even to the fact that when I was coming, probably as a little child, maybe when I don't really don't remember, my parents were driving north to, you know, in the 60s or whatever, or the early 60s, whenever, to visit. You really couldn't even stop in Virginia back in the early 60s. I remember asking my sister, why did mom always pack a lunch? And I we didn't stop at restaurants. She goes, well, in Virginia, we couldn't stop at restaurants. Can you really, in my lifetime, this
Mine
is
as
how
well.
backwards America was at that time, and having Jim Crow laws that made no sense at all. You know, it made no sense, because now it's obvious that Jim Crow held America back for so many
Truly.
years. 60
True.
years of digression and unneeded oppression. You know,
Right.
it was there was already slavery. Musicians, this is what my I champion the cause of how important it was that white America would have embraced the black musical experience, because it was a contribution Everyone contributed, but we were the catalyst by virtue of the theory of the music.
Right, right.
That came out of West Africa.
Right.
And so that gift was that you had your minor third blues, you know, all those things, the rumba beat, all those things came out of West Africa. And so here we are handing this gift and also saying that, you know, what I see from the musician side of it is like, okay, even our people were not the very first slaves on the planet.
Right.
It's just that you said you wanted to end slavery. And so we did. And then they decided, well, but it's not really quite over.
Right.
Because
right,
we got to, we can't really allow you to like go into everywhere and eat. And I said, well, what happened? I thought you guys wanted, there was this constitution, you know, and all along we're contributing all this incredible music now. Mm-hmm. So now turn of the century in the late 1800s, you know, the black musicians are emulating their fellow black, you know, former slaves and slaves. And these were people who were now singing these minstrels and work songs that were now being, transposed onto instruments. And there was a cornet player now, and there was a clarinet player singing those blues, those minstrel, those cadences. And that particular theory that came out of Africa starts to evolve in America in its own form.
Mm. Mm.
And so here we, you know, and...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And coming to Connecticut at that time, I'm hearing all the music I'm hearing is in the church.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so here's a direct, you know, descendant of the music that comes, you know, from the turn it from the days of slavery into the modern era now, which is the early precursors for what we know as our jazz, our gospel,
blues,
our R&B. And then we realize it's all coming out of the church. It's coming out of the church. The church is the real propagator at that time of the music and what it was going to be, you know. Eventually, the church ladies will go, no, don't go on over in that secular stuff too long.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Don't get on over there that rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, stay on over here with the Lord.
Because... Don't be playing them blues.
Yeah, don't be playing them blues and playing that saxophone in the church, you know. Like, no saxophone? I go, no, not yet.
Yeah.
My cousins, my grandfather, they all sang in the church. And I was mesmerized by that, you know, I went in search of, via my dad, we would always have these very heavy discussions about history. And at an early age, I was interested in where does this music come from, you know? Because being the mind that I had, even as a little kid, I would ask my grandfather, why do you have this little book? He had his hymn book.
Oh, go, yeah.
And I'd stand between his legs and he'd be practicing his, you know, singing his hymns before church, and I'd oftentimes spend the night over my grandparents, and then there would be my grandfather. And it was him singing these gospel, and you know, all this came from that and was affecting me, because now I'm hearing it in the house, and I'm hearing it in the church. Now I'm seeing people, I'm at the age now where I'm cognizant of what are these church people singing? And now it's affecting me because I can feel it.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, but that was my cousins and my grandfather. So they all influenced me. They didn't go on to be professional musicians in my family, but they certainly had a lasting influence on me.
Yeah, Now, what made you choose clarinet?
Because they didn't have any saxophones. And nowhere in the world I want to play a clarinet, bro.
That, That's the reason why I play clarinet. They had no saxes. So.
There were no saxes. As you well know, the band teacher said, "What do you want to play?" You go, "Saxophone."
Right.
And they go, "Dude, we don't have any more saxes. Everybody wants to play the saxophone."
Right, right, right.
I said, "What do you got?" He goes, "Clarinets." I go, "Oh, no, no, no." I said, "I can't even go home with that little case, bro." I'm going to get jacked up. Can you be like a saxophone case or something, you know?
Yeah, please. I played clarinet up to high school, and when that's when I switched to flute. But because I'm trying to play in top 40 bands and stuff like trying to play some Earth, Wind, and Fire, and
rough on the clarinet.
Yeah, man, I could, you know, it wasn't cool, and it was, you know, playing cool in the gang, and you playing clarinets. Like, say, wait a minute, bro. When did you switch to sax?
Well. So I did the same thing when I went to Ripon. The band teachers, they didn't have enough clarinet players, first of all.
Mm.
And they wanted me to be like first chair. And then, of course, you know, you're in every band. You're in the marching band, the concert band, the orchestra, you know. And it was pretty amazing that we had those different variations of bands in school, because you had... You had the concert, you had the choir, then you had the concert band, then you had the orchestral band. So I played in all of those different, I played in the orchestra, the concert band, marching band. And at the same time, my teacher was my mentor in Reform. And so he was, Anthony Truglia. He took me under his wing, was a true mentor, even gave me lessons after school.
Oh, wow.
And we went off to Europe with the high school, with the Ripon High School band. I was there, the company we worked for, they sold Italian instruments, and there was a Borghani saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "You can get this Borghani saxophone." I think they said it was like going to be $200. And then I said, "Well, when I get back home, I'm going to send for one of these." And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me the sax from Italy. I got the soprano sax. It kind of looked more like a clarinet. I had never played one.
Mm.
But I found out it was easier to play than the clarinet. Clarinet is a much harder instrument to play because, you know, in clarinet, that is not the octave key is not the same note
as it is
on flute and saxophone. You know?
And you got to cover those holes up as opposed to cover those holes.
Yeah. So that was a whole different ball game. Except that I really didn't start on the soprano. I kind of played around with it. I got a gig, I don't know what to call it, a gig. But, you know, we started playing with our little junior high school band. Mm-hmm. See, that's how far back I go. It was called junior high. It wasn't even middle school.
Oh, right.
And I went to Turner River Junior High.
Yeah, I did too.
And then I got the, what was it? It was the summer. So we would go 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And then that summer from 9th going into Ripon, I was going to be a sophomore. I went in as a sophomore, not a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
That year, that summer, a guy was having a party down at the little park down at the end of like West End and Stanford, that little park that's over there that used to be near our house. As you were going down towards Greenwich, there's a little park to the right down there. And so at that little park, they were going to have a little cookout. And the guy said, "I'd like to hire your little band," and my little junior high school band. Okay, that'd be great. And he goes, "Well, you play saxophone, right?" I go, "Yeah, I can play sax." You know, but like he said, "Can you play?" You know, kids, they just. And then he goes, "Okay, good. We'll get you a sax." I said, "I don't have a sax." He goes, "But we'll rent you one." I had never even picked up the sax.
Oh, dang.
He rented me a tenor. And so I had a couple of days to get it together, and I figured it out. I got to read. Went to the gig, took out my clarinet. I was blowing on the clarinet. I took out that sax, and then I was faking it, but I got through it.
Okay.
You know, you're probably looking at me like, "You don't play that sax as good as that clarinet," but not that bad. So, but I had the rental for 3 months, and he says, "At the end of the summer, you take it back to the store. I've rented it. They only do 3 months at a time."
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the summer, my mom bought the sax because the band teacher, when I took it with me to school, he goes, "Oh, great, you play sax now. You got a sax now." I go, no, I don't own it. I'm renting it. Mm. And then I told my mom that he wants me to play sax and clarinet in the band. Mm. And so it was a used horn anyway. So my mom bought it for me. Nice. And so that was when I started playing sax when I got to high school.
Okay.
So it was a long, I didn't even pick it up until high school. So that's my point.
Wow. You know, it's interesting, man. Tenor saxophone is my favorite instrument. Never played one.
Really?
I have an alto.
I need to sing you some of my straight ahead stuff on tenor so you can, I need to sing you some of my straight ahead music. I don't know if you've ever gotten any of them. I heard my straight ahead stuff.
I've heard you play it back in the day.
But, yeah, no, I have some recordings of it.
Oh,
now,
yeah,
so
no. Yeah, yeah.
I'll send you over some. Yeah.
Please, please. Yeah. I was just telling somebody the other day, man, I remember you playing tenor at the Foundry. And there was one night, all the stars aligned and everything, man. And you were killing it, man. And I'll never forget. I tell everybody about it all the time. I was sitting there, and after you finished playing, I was there, me and Danny and a couple other people, and we just sat there just looking. It's like, wow, man, did you hear that? Yeah, I heard it. He just took us someplace, man. I'm not sure where we went, but he took us someplace.
Oh, man. Wow.
That tenor, man, you used to kill that tenor, man.
Yeah.
I haven't seen you play tenor in a long time.
Yeah, man, I got one over there. It's right over here.
Okay.
Ready to go.
Yeah, man. So you played all through school, played in different bands and stuff.
Yeah.
And then
as I got towards my senior year, I was, you know, I wasn't even going to go to, you know, I went to Berkeley, but I wasn't going to go to Berkeley until my senior year. I was going to go to school for sciences. I wanted to be a zoo vet. I wanted to be a zoologist. I wanted to work I was very serious about that. It was not like just, you know, like I want to be a police officer or be a veterinarian.
Right.
I really, that's the stuff I studied. I studied all the chemistry and the biology, but I played music. I had no intention of going off to be a professional musician at that time.
Right.
You know, I was kind of, you know, getting those skills under my hat of, you know, and the being able to read the music and play it and interpret it and then maybe play jazz. All of those things started to align, and then I realized, well, you know what? I'm actually been groomed to be a pretty good musician. I've been trained the proper way. I've got the natural instincts for it, and that's when we went up to Berkeley on a field trip with Tony Truglia.
Okay.
And while we were there, they were like, any of your music students that want to audition, while you're here at Berkeley, we're offering an audition. And I did. So, you know, because they said bring our instruments.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I auditioned on soprano sax.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on my little Borgani. Mm-hmm. I decided I was going to do it on there, and they handed you some music to play, and then you play whatever you want, and then some jazz standard or something. And then I went off to Europe with the band. Only thing, I'm going to come back and start doing like my kind of pre-med stuff, to tell you the truth. But Berkeley had sent me a letter saying they wanted me to come to Berkeley.
Oh, wow.
And that was kind of a time where Berkeley was a little tougher to get into.
Yeah, really, I was getting ready to say, yeah.
Yeah, we had Bill Pierce up there. We had John Scofield. Mm. There were some monsters up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when, you know, I was in Europe and my mom was saying, how's it going over there? And I go, yeah, mom's going good. And she goes, you know what, you know, mothers and those that call everything little, your little flute, your little horn, you know, go get your little music book, you know.
Right,
I said,
Mom,
why does everything got to be little? Because you're little, she said. And then she says, you know, that little music school, they accepted you to that little music school in Boston. And I go, huh? And I go, Berkeley? She goes, yeah. And I go, well, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll think about going to music school. She hung up on me. I said, uh-oh.
Yeah. No, you're supposed to be a doctor, man.
I had to put in a slip to have a meeting with the parents. Put in a request for for a sit down for the idea of going to music school. And they went along with it. And that was it. I went off to Berkeley only to find out that there were amazing young musicians from all over the world.
Wow. Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what was the Berklee experience like, man, especially during that period of time?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't know 18-year-old kids could play like this. There were such amazing musicians that were there. I think it's always been the case at Berklee, and there have been years when, you know, absolute killers have come out of Berklee, and I'm just happy to be there. I wanted to do more work with the orchestra and stuff. We didn't have an orchestra at Berklee, but you can go around the corner to Boston Conservatory hire string players at like $25 a string. Most college kids don't have $25 per string player,
right. But
that was pretty cheap back in those days. And when we needed to do an orchestral piece, we had to go hire, you know, either conservatory or the, you know, Boston School of Music. So, which was, we had Boston Conservatory, and then the one that Jay and Nelson went to.
New England?
New England Conservatory.
Okay, yeah,
that
yeah,
was
yeah.
right down the road, yeah.
Okay.
Jay Rowe, which, by the way, people are missing, Jay Rowe,
and
Najee.
Yeah.
And Nelson Rangel are all products of New England Conservatory, you know.
Yeah.
The competition.
Yeah. You know, I opened for Najee at the Webster in Hartford, and I knew he played flute. This was going back a ways. I knew he played flute, but I had always heard him play sax. I seen him in concert. He'd only played sax. And so I was saying to my bass player, I said, man, I'm going to start taking lessons again. He said, why? I said, because there's another level that I want to get to playing-wise. And he looked at me strange. We get there to the sound check, and Najee didn't play any sax in the sound check. He played all flute. And he was killing it, man, playing all this classical stuff, man. He was killing it. So my bass player walks over to me and said, now I understand. He was killing.
I mean, that was that era when we came up. It was, you know, you just studied so much and you always took it to the next level. It's really all we had, because our contemporaries, you know, and the people we looked up to were all such monsters.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And then we lived next to New York City. So you go into New York.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
New York City, they tell you to take your butt on back to Connecticut. You know, but they would always tell you to come back. And keep, you know, let's face it, the music business, even back in those days, was challenged in the sense that if you were going to do this as a full-time living, that was going to be a challenge in itself. And how do you navigate that, sustain that, and make that work for your livelihood going forward?
Right.
So we were given, one scenario was that if you're going to write music, make sure you write your music, publish your music. If you're going to play your instrument, make sure that every day there's a new challenge for you on the instrument that you challenge yourself. You know, it's why sometimes I'm hard on the church guys, especially the keyboard players who learn by ear. There's nothing wrong with learning music by ear. That's not a problem at all. But when you're a keyboard player and you get complacent in the church and you're such a good keyboard player, but you really haven't learned the music yet, you're just, you know, just naturally good on the instrument. Then I get on them and I say, well, God, with YouTube now, pen and piano, you can know exactly what you're playing in probably only 1 month's time, you know. And then you can spend more time learning how to sight read. But you need to always augment whatever you're doing with what's available, be it a teacher. And then certainly today, there's so much you can learn online. I mean, you can't learn the instrument online, but you can learn certain shortcuts and things that have been tried and true, proven methods that would help you get to the place where you need to go. That's why I always, right now, I actually even say that kids probably don't even need to go past 10th grade in school anymore, you know, when you really think about it. How many children, what are you really learning in 11th and 12th grade anymore?
Right.
That you could already be applying to what's going to be next in your life. At 16 years old, you could already be engineering and planning what's going to be your path for entrepreneurship, for success, for just working in general. Mm. I think a lot of countries now are cutting out those 12 years of school only because there's so much information online. And if you teach children that if you strive for excellence and already have an idea where you want to go. I mean, I think a lot of kids today, even the musicians, think that there's an online shortcut to how do you get to success. And maybe some cases there are, but that's not going to be for everyone.
Yeah, no,
there's not going to be a shortcut to learning the instrument like we did. Mm-hmm. But there are advantages to maybe creating your brand, you know, and how you can do that. If you're going to be a musician, you can create your brand. It's a different scenario today. It's much more internet-based, as we well know. I fought it for a long time, man. You know, I've done all these things to be Marion Meadows, you know, like you were talking about Najee. We did all these things to get to the point where we have a voice. And then all of a sudden, it was like we were the dinosaurs when it came to this internet thing.
Yeah.
You know, there were so much more successful artists online than us online. Not so much that we weren't successful, but on the online presence,
right,
with all the Facebook and the Instagrams and all. And I was like, I don't want to do that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But then I found out I had
to do it. Yeah.
It wasn't like I don't want to do it. It's like if you don't do it in any jobs today, you won't even get hired if you don't have an internet presence. They won't even call you back.
Yeah. I know a lot of places won't take packages anymore. They want you, if you don't have your promo package online, they won't even consider you
at all. Yeah. Mm. So I had to learn those lessons, and you know, getting back to that process, and that's what it is. It is a process. I think every day now for me, I make notes on what's going to be. When the days I just want to relax and do nothing, I've had to teach myself to not get up and start doing something because I'm more motivated to stick to my list when I do, because I'm probably ADHD all the way, you know. But I asked my mom, you know, what was ADHD in our day? She goes, that was called a butt whooping.
Exactly.
She goes, y'all ain't had no time for that. We jacked your little butt up.
Exactly.
We jacked you up. Like, you don't have no ADHD, you know? ADHD was like, Mom, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll get that.
Yeah, right. Beat that ADHD right on out.
Yeah, right on out of here.
Yeah, man.
But for me, I do a lot of different things. You know, I'll go paint, and then I'll come in here and I'll record. But I do that a lot. And so that's why I have to make myself some days just maybe sit down and watch a movie or something, and chill, because I'm always doing something. And gotcha. I was like that even when I was a child.
Hi, my name is Howard Cloud. Please watch In the Black of My Mind with host Al Thomas.
Child. Hmm. You know, that's for the young musicians coming up. The advice I give, the number one advice is the integrity part and showing up on time. You know, if you're a musician and you feel as though you have the gift to be a professional musician and make it in this business, then you already have that in your mind. And there's nothing that I could do to stop you from doing that. And I wouldn't want to stop you.
Right.
What I would want to do is encourage you to make sure that when you do get that first big call, you're going to be there like half an hour early.
Right.
You know, and you're going to already be warmed up and ready to go, whatever you play, because that's what they look for. That's what the people look. They're not hiring you because they're shopping around. They're hiring you because of what you do already.
Right.
And it's been great. And one thing about Najee, if we're still talking about Najee at all, was that he used to sneak up to the Foundry Cafe, which you mentioned before, to listen to Ron Lawrence.
Oh, wow.
And then he came out with his album, his first album, which was produced by Ronnie Song.
Uh-huh.
and stole Ron, went on the road. I was mad, bro. I told Najee, man, I was mad. I'm going to come down to Queens and,
come
and
in the
blow
kitchen.
Up your horn, man.
Man, I so miss Ronnie, man. Oh, yeah. Man, I miss that brother.
Me too. Damn. Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
Oh, I know you do, man. Please.
Man, he was a force even beyond just you and, you know, and I, you and I knowing him, but he was a force for so many other people.
Yeah.
Tenure with Boney James and then of course Najee took him on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I was so happy for him, you know, I'm just joking. But for Ron, who was just unique as a person. Never mind playing the guitar. When he picked up the guitar, you were like, dude, who does this?
right.
Who plays like this? You know. Guitar players from all over the world, the most highly trained guys, the guys who, you know, the fusion guys, the super jazz guys. Anybody ever saw Ron Lawrence, they probably, just for a fleeting moment, probably said, I might stop playing after hearing this guy.
Yeah, no
I might
doubt.
Take my guitar and throw
no
it.
Doubt.
In the river after hearing this guy.
Yeah.
Know, so,
yeah.
I mean, that's how beast. Amazing Ron was.
Yeah,
you know?
He was a beast. Yeah.
Hi, this is Greg Thomas of Parliament Funkadelic, and you're listening to In the Black of My Mind podcast. Check us out. Woof.
Yeah.
When did you know that you were going to make music your life?
Well, I pretty much after I stepped foot in Berkeley. And then, so I had to make a decision right there because now, you know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I was a good musician. I was as far as being a musician and knowing that I would have the abilities to be a professional musician, I was by no means the greatest saxophone player, young kid saxophone player in the world, but I knew there was a process at that point. Mm-hmm. And I understood what process meant because I had been trained as a musician and all this mentoring. Part of that mentoring that Mr. Truglia used to give us was also about life. It was also about what you're gonna do in life, you know, respect you have for your parents, everything from hygiene to life in general. And I'm just a kid. But this is what some young people need. They need a mentor who's not necessarily their mother or father.
Right.
Somebody says, gets down and dirty, say, yo, bro, you know, you know, how you do? Are you doing your grades? You taking care of this? You taking care of that? So the checking the boxes. Because not just being a musician is just not good enough. You still got to be a citizen, and you got to be able to survive, and you got to be able to pay your rent, and you got to be able to, you know, all of those things.
Right.
So that coaching all, you know, translated into what was going to come next. So when I made that decision, I said, "Well, am I going to go to Berkeley? Is this going to be a novelty, or am I going to end up wanting to go back to the science thing?" And then I arrived there. And I was like every kid when the first day you go off to college, it's a scary feel. It's not scary, but it's exciting at the same time, but it's a little awkward, you know, and you are a freshman. So, you know, it's just so awkward. You go like, so what are we going to do here? Like, and then you pass, like for me at Berkeley, then I'd see like a senior, like horn player or somebody, you know, and at that time, I think even John Scofield was graduating and he was starting to teach his first year. He's been a student, you know. I was overwhelmed. And then I realized, wow, I want to be like these guys. And I want to set up what this process is going to be in my mind so that I can make a timeline. And that timeline would involve practicing every day. You know, showing up for my classes and all those sorts of things. And when it did start to happen and fall into place, I said, this feels good. This feels good. It feels like this was meant for me to do this. And whatever that was along the way coming up. And I appreciate all those math and science skills to have because I'm already eclectic as a person and asking too many questions because my parents are like, oh, no, here he comes. You know, I'd be wearing my parents out. How come they do this? What do they do? You know, that's just this is the kind of kid I was. So I got to Berkeley, and I did. I would ask questions. I would ask questions to my instructors and fellow musicians. So you know, if you do embark on that lifestyle, and then you realize this is it. This is I think I can do this. Mm-hmm. Then there's no stopping you. But you have to make that process no different than if it was a perpetual learning experience that every day you wake up and at least hope that you learned something new today, because we can never learn it all in one passing of this life.
No doubt. And when you stop learning, you start dying, basically.
Yeah, you start dying. You do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I haven't hit that wall yet. Where I've stopped learning because every day I learn something new. And especially now with all the technology incorporating all that. Here we are, look, you know, we're on all these computers and online streaming, and you had to learn that technology. It's not like you just turn the thing on. You got to understand about audio, and we do engineering, incorporate those things into our process as well.
Oh, yeah. And especially in light of the music industry, the shift in the music industry, if you will.
Yes.
You know, because there's no more brick and mortar. We're not doing the albums and cassettes and CDs for that matter. You know.
I mean,
there's a few dinosaurs out there, but for the most part, you know, it's all streaming now. So you know, we have to. What does that look like now? I got to learn what that's all about, and you know. And the business of music changed considerably. So now that's a whole nother process as well. It's not like before you could, you know, you go and even at the low end, you make a project and you can sell it out the trunk of your car. That's not a reality anymore.
No, it's not. And you're right. It was a much more lucrative time in those days. By virtue of product, there was a product, and the product, as we all knew it, was this big LP. It was, you know, and in the making of that product was this process of recording it. It was recorded to tape, not digital. Mm-hmm. So you had to have this big giant,
right.
2-inch. If you were recording in a recording studio, and so everything we knew was big 2-inch MPEG tape. Tascam, two track mixed down, and then cassette, or the album itself. And at that time it was all LP.
Right.
So, and then there was an art to, cause the thing was 12 inches. So the picture you put in it had to be some really very artful thing. It's not like it was a little teeny little thing. I mean, you were looking at this 12x12, piece of artwork. Many cases they opened up then, and so somebody had to learn that, and some of us went along as time went on. Some of us learned how to do graphic design our own covers, photography, all those.
I think
that's the reason. People say to me, why are you like a photographer? I said, because half that stuff we had to learn ourselves. I remember when I first started building websites, I wasn't building a website. You had to go hire somebody to build a website for you.
Right, exactly.
No one could do that back in the day. There was no software program. There was no.
No.
There was no content aware kind of programs, and there was. I think I first started on with Dreamweaver.
Oh yeah.
And I went to Adobe, and then I went to the Phoenix School Art Institute. And they offered a class in website design and a little CSS class. I mean, not even CSS. It was HTML back then.
Okay.
So you could learn some coding. And mostly what I wanted to learn about coding is how do I code in pictures into a website and text and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned that. Next thing I know, I'm building websites from scratch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you just said, I'm going to go as far as to say that, in retrospect to that, when you made a record back in those days, for a record company, The wholesale basic, let's say just the basic wholesale price for that was $10, you know. And if a record company sold 100,000 records, they made $1 million. They made $1 million off 100,000. It doesn't sound like much, but if you sold 1 million records,
right,
that's a whole different ballgame at $10. You know.
Yeah.
So now you just sold 1 million records, and the record company, but it wasn't just 1 million records. Now you're like Whitney Houston. You sold 50 million records. That's a company that's in business.
Right.
They've just made billions of dollars off an art, one artist. Billions, not millions, billions. So record companies were very lucrative back then when they had artists, even in the jazz side, because when I went to RCA on the Novus label, we typically sold in excess of 100, 200, 300,000 albums. Okay. And we were jazz guys, jazz artists in the beginning. I think my first record was 160,000 records. But Najee's was 500,000. I'm still mad.
Right. Hey, everybody, it's your girl, Cece Peniston. And finally, you're watching in the Black of My Mind podcast with Al Thomas.
Of course, that's unheard of today. Nobody sells 100,000 of anything anymore because there's no product.
Right.
The streaming then we went into the era of the cassettes, but they were still selling a product. Again, wholesale probably $10, $12, even made a wholesale, because if you remember, the cassette prices went up a little higher from when they were starting. They sold records, and I believe we bought records for around $10, somewhere around. They were around, I don't know, $10. No, they were higher. Actually, albums would sell as much as $15 to $20 sometimes, LPs. You would get a discount if you got a record at, I think, $8 and $10 for an album.
Okay.
The cassettes then went up, if I'm not mistaken, a little bit higher than that. And at first, when the CDs came out, CDs could be as much as $18 for a CD. Which was a lot of money when you thought about it compared to what it used to be. But again, the record company is still making a profit off of a product. And you fast forward to today, and a musician. So what is a musician? How do they make their money? We had more clubs back in those days that played live music. And if you were talking about the Foundry Cafe back in the late 70s and early 80s, playing at the Foundry Cafe, we were making probably, compared to what musicians make now, we were probably making five or six times more money than they make now back then.
Because
you could get $200 or $300 a night in a little. Nobody gets $300 a night on a Tuesday night.
Right.
Playing in a club anymore. You know, you have to be a top professional to get that. But if you're just a band, a jam band, and you're making. Each guy's making $200 or $300 a night because that's what the clubs would pay you.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And we would get paid. So we were getting paid as up and coming musicians, so we could play full time, get an apartment, buy a car, you know, get to the gig, buy equipment. And according to what my parents said, of all the three kids who went off to college, the music kid was the one that didn't have to borrow any money because he had a gig. I go, how about that? The one you thought that was going to be the one coming back to the bank all the time.
Right.
Never had to borrow any money because I had a gig.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
But yeah, today the challenge is very challenging because your revenue stream has been considerably cut down for a musician who's now an adult. So you're not a kid anymore. You're now 21, 22, 23 years old. You started your career. Maybe you want to get married or have a family, whatever. But how do you do that if you don't have a revenue stream?
Exactly.
And so like you alluded to, you have to now start about what are the alternatives that is an online presence, is a recording abilities, parlaying that into something that you can monetize. So it's a much more challenging scenario now. But, you know, the young people are figuring it out.
And
it might not have the same longevity and sustenance that we had So there's going to be some room for adjusting. And each, I'm going to say every few years for today's professional musician, they have to adjust to what's coming next, you know.
Gotcha.
To survive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt. No doubt. How did you get started professionally?
Norman Garner's actually. My first story for playing on professional gigs was that as soon as I stepped foot into the clubs, mm-hmm. you were a professional musician at that point, because mm-hmm. now I'm making as much as $1,000 a week playing music. Mm-hmm. I'm a professional now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as far as being a recording artist and then, you know, playing on my first albums, that would have been back in the time of the Norman Conners days when I got on my, the very first album I was on was a Vicky Sue Robinson, you know, Turn the Beat Around, not oh, on yeah, that yeah. song, but on one of her albums, Vicky right. Sue Robinson. I played on one song, and Ronnie Song produced the Williams Brothers Gospel, Williams Brothers. Mm-hmm. I played on one or two songs on their album. So that was my first foray into doing like, and then we had an album out with Joey Melotti. So he had an LP out. So mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm on a couple of albums now. So mm-hmm. I must be a professional musician. So. and after that, Norman Conners, I had played with Norman Conners through Jock Berbick, who was with Aquarian Dream. Mm-hmm. Duke Jones and I had written some music with Jock. Mm-hmm. They were already in the band with Norman, touring, doing this, you know, My Starship and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And Betcha by Golly Wild, Phyllis Hyman. So when I met them, I had already recorded some music for him. And we went to California. I was working a day job at the time. And he hired me to be in the band. So that was it. I never looked back. And I was off and running at that point. I never had to get another day job after that.
Right.
Well, I shouldn't say that. That's not true. Because that is not true. Because I was touring all over the world with Norman Conners. That doggone Najee, he's going to keep coming up in this conversation. his ears must be buzzing, or his butt is itching or something. Because I always talk to him about that, because, you know, as much as I talk about him, he's one of my dearest friends in the world. Mm. He came out with his album during the time I was with Norman Conners. I immediately quit my job with Norman Conners. I knew how long it would take, the process of getting an album done.
Okay.
And I quit my job with Norman, and I took a job with Pitney Bowes in Stanford.
Wow.
And I worked in the machine shop so that I could record at night and do my For Lovers Only album. So I did take another day job, and then I started studying at Purchase to finish my, all my stuff for school. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To get to the point where I want to, you know, get on my degree and all that kind of stuff. So I just said, well, now I'm going to get my own record done. How am I going to do this? So again, I just said, and my parents said, what are you doing? I said, well, I quit my job working with Norman Conners. They said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to have to give up my apartment. And I'll have to move back home. My parents said, huh? They're like, wait.
So we got everybody out. We
got everybody out. Good. What are you doing? I said, I got to move back home. I got to be able to get to Pitney Bowes, run down that hill every day.
Yeah, you know? Wow.
You might have seen me running down the hill to Pitney Bowes down to Stillwater. But I did. And I got that record done, took a job in Japan with Duke Jones. Touring in Japan, and while I was in Japan, Worthy Patterson, who ended up working for William Morris, gives his tape to his dad, who was a executive at RCA, but he was more of a in the administrative side of RCA, not an A&R guy. He passed it on to Steve Backer, and I get a phone call in Japan, and they said, "Hey, man, we like your tape." Which was just a cassette, because you turned in a cassette. They said, we like your tape. Can you come back to New York and we can have some conversations? And that's what I did. I came back, and about a month later, they signed me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Marion and I started talking and catching up, and I learned so much from him. But this podcast was so long that we had to make it two parts. So what I'm going to need you to do is tune back in and check out part two as well. In the meantime, I need you to do me that favor and subscribe, like, and share with everybody. All right? Y'all be blessed. This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe, and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. With 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply. Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.